Scalpel with Dr. Keith Rose. Cutting down to the truth through history and experience, The Scalpel is proudly sponsored by Z-Bone's Bone Conducting Headphones. Learn more at zbones.io. Subscribe to The Scalpel wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at The Scalpel Podcast, on Twitter at The Scalpel Edge. Email kfr at scalpeledge.com or the website scalpeledge.com. The next episode of The Scalpel starts now.
Welcome to The Scalpel. This is Dr. Keith Rose. We have a special guest today on The Scalpel. We have a dear friend of mine and someone who understands more about the swamp, the counter state, and what's actually going on in this country than pretty much anyone else that I know. Rich Higgins and I, Richard T. Higgins, if I'm going to use his full name, we met several years ago while I was visiting in Washington, D.C., and we all ended up in the same room, and we all realized we had the same goals, those goals being the continuation of the freest nation in the world. We both recognized that there was a problem in this country, and when I was talking to Rich, I didn't meet anyone else my entire time in D.C. that had it down so succinctly and really understood what was going on. In fact, during that time, Rich wrote a memo that came out and raised the ire of several people in the National Security Council where Rich was working at that time in 2017. So the memo caused a lot of consternation and problems, and now Rich has released the book, The Memo, that really explains what the deep state, which what we like to call the counter state, is doing and how it's affecting our country. To give you a little background, Rich served as a national security surrogate and counterterrorism advisor for President Trump's campaign in 2016. And later, he served on President Trump's National Security Council as director of strategic planning, during which time he worked to uncover the Crossfire Hurricane illegal surveillance operation targeting President Trump. So before a lot of people were even talking about it, Rich was quietly working behind the scenes with several other people trying to figure out what exactly was going on. Prior to that, from 2011 to 2013, Rich managed a classified project for Special Operations Command, SOCOM, and from 2010 to 2011, he served as the chair of Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict at the National Defense University. He's currently CEO of HTG LLC and develops and tests new combat capabilities, that's what this company does, for special operations, intelligence, and information warfare. He also serves as director of Unconstrained Analytics, which is a national security 501c3 that does amazing work. So without any other ado, welcome, Rich.
Hey, Keith. It's great to talk to you.
Rich, you, by your accent, I know you're not from Texas, and everyone else knows that too. So what were you seeing when I met you in 2017, what was your impetus for writing the memo? Because I remember when I met you, you showed me the memo. I don't even know if you had put it out at that time yet.
Well, I think, you know, having been with the campaign and, you know, supported them through the transition, you know, being friends with General Flynn, knowing Bannon, knowing several other the actors around the president, we were concerned early on, you know, as early as November, shortly after the win, literally within days of the win, that things weren't going normal, right? Things weren't going or proceeding as normal, what we would expect to see. And so, you know how it is, your tactical instincts go up, you start paying attention to what's happening around you, you monitor a little bit more closely who's talking to who. And it was clear that some interesting activities were going on, in those last two or three months of the Obama administration. A lot of things that have not made the public discussion yet, to include, you know, the deletion of presidential records or you know, just certain activities by corporate partners of the Obama administration in and around the National Security Council, which I'm sure Attorney General Barr and U.S. Attorney Durham will eventually bring to light. But at the scale and the magnitude of what they're looking into, as somebody who, you know, experienced it up close, it's just enormous. So rolling out, you know, post-inauguration, it was clear to us that there was an operation underway, you know, I mean, and things that, you know, I know you've been downrange before, I've been downrange. We know what an operation looks like. We may not know exactly who's behind it, who's controlling it, you know, what its ultimate end state or goal is, but you can tell, and over time, you just, you know, you detect a fact pattern, you detect a series of observations, and you start asking the right questions. It was clear to me there was an operation being run. I wasn't sure by whom at the time. And later, you know, we would come to find out that it was this operation, you know, what now the world knows as Crossfire Hurricane, Crossfire Razor, this series of operations targeting the campaign, the transition, and then the presidency of Donald Trump.
I remember when we first met back in 2017, and we were both comparing notes with each other because, like you said, we both kind of felt something was going on. I had certain experiences, and you did too. You were much closer to the administration than I was, and you were seeing an opposition to this president develop. Kind of build out what you were seeing for us as far as what kind of opposition you were seeing, not just the typical opposition you would see, Democrat versus Republican, but drill down a little bit, because I've heard you explain this before, and I think it's important that the listeners know what we're up against as a nation and the depth and the organization that the opposition has.
Well, I think you're, in order to kind of frame in order to frame what we saw during the transition and the up in the startup of the Trump administration, I think you have to go back a few years. I mean, what you really have to understand the Obama presidency, and particularly the last 2 years of the Bush presidency. So, you know, the Democrats took control of the House, I think, in 2006. And what you saw after that was inside the national security apparatus, Democrat political operators were moved into positions, even though it was a quote unquote Bush presidency. They kind of governed from the middle, and that allowed a lot of very left-wing activists to take advantage of the situation. So when Obama came in, they really drove home the hard left agenda through things like Presidential Study Directive 11, their counterterrorism policies, which were, you know, extremely prohibitive, their generation of rules of engagement, which I'm sure you're familiar with, rules of engagement that were compliant with Islamic law in places like Afghanistan, which, you know, saw our soldiers being put in prison for not abiding by rules that were, you know, designed to constrain them as foreign occupiers and so on and so forth. So,
yeah, the counterterrorism manual changed drastically in the wording.
Exactly. So you see this plethora of bad actors in place. What we didn't really understand, and I, you know, there were always rumblings about it, you know, was the abuses going on of the surveillance, right? And there were rumblings about it in and around the community that, you know, it had been abused, or it was perhaps being abused. And this goes back to like the Jane Harmon stuff, if you remember that, and then the Menendez. I mean, but you have to really look at, you know, how was the Obama administration able to absolutely shut down dissent within the Democratic Party? I mean, you weren't allowed to get out of line, right? If you did, they went after you.
They were lockstep. Yeah,
absolutely. And how, what did he have on them that gave him this power to demand this? I mean, it was beyond anything we'd ever seen before. So these abuses, what, you know, what later were discovered in terms of the signals intelligence abuses, these abuses began long before Crossfire Hurricane, or they started on General Flynn. And so this pattern of abuse that went on over years in the Obama administration really became inculcated in these institutions. And so what we saw, you know, during the transition was a concerted effort by some of the benefactors of this, you know, I call it perversion of our republic, began to get their assets and people into the Trump administration. And they purposely got their agents into the transition team. They got them into key nodes where they would be able to influence the national security personnel selections. And, you know, and President Trump's a businessman. I mean, he thinks he's running a business,
And he made the same mistake, actually, I think, that General Grant made. I mean, General Grant, if you read his memoirs, he talks about when he became the president, he tried to run the presidency like he was running his general staff in the Civil War. And he failed because of it. And he talks about, you know, I didn't realize that being a politician and running the White House wasn't running, you know, the Union Army. And I think that the president kind of made the same mistake. He fell into thinking he could run it like he ran his business or his investment strategies, not realizing that personnel is policy. And so what we saw was infiltration, subversion. And you asked a question. There were things that the public saw generally, which were things like the leaks of the telephone calls with the presidents of Australia and the president of Mexico, right? I mean, obvious things above the fold New York Times things. There were also things that we saw inside, document portfolios missing, meetings being sabotaged, personnel being, you know, that the president had wanted to bring into his administration being blocked. And it wasn't just Obama holdovers that were doing this. There were actors inside of the Republican sphere that were doing the same. So it was really, it was the Trump team versus everybody. And so what we saw was I always compare it. I like my World War II analogies. I think we were like the Allied Expeditionary Force in Europe, right? Getting run off of Dunkirk. And, you know, we had to get completely pounded off and then reset. And, you know, I think what we're coming up to here is on November 3rd, this is the beginning of, you know, the Normandy invasion, that the president is resetting, is going to go in. And, you know, the last time I was talking to some of the members of the first family, one of the things that they said was, you know, we'd like to give him the first term that he never had.
That's
I don't think there's a better analogy than the one you just used in World War II, because I guess you and I, when we met, we were kind of like the French resistance behind the lines. We were trying to figure out what was going on and understand the depth of it. I remember talking to you, and I mean, I think we met for hours, and I had a list of notes, you had a list of notes, and we were trying to cross our ints or, you know, see what information we had that made sense. And what you were seeing was not only, like you said, the Democrats, but a lot of Republicans that I believe, especially time has shown, and you and I had this conversation 3 to 4 years ago, that were working in lockstep with the Democrats, because the Democrats had the ideology driving them and the Republicans had this quest for power, and they really didn't. They were kind of all co-opted and blended together when President Trump came in, because he threatened so many different sections of government that while they may not have been aligned identically, they were cohabitating in the same battle space.
Yeah, I think one hand washed the other, if you will, right? I mean, you hear often spoken about the quote unquote, the uniparty. It's this kind of convergence of interests where on the left, the socialist, statist, globalists kind of, you know, they coagulate over there. And then you on the right, you have the sort of corporatist globalists over there. And the, you know, the common denominator there being the globalist interests that, you know, are driving, you know, the government to greater and greater service provision to facilitate, you know, the corporations ever expanding markets and lower cost of labor, et cetera. Right. So it's this.
Right. The large hotels that have to have the labor just for everyone else out there. You know, these big globalists need that less expensive labor.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you have a. But the point is really that the American middle class was trapped in this pincer movement, right, where neither of the parties necessarily represented their interests. And in comes this civilian, non-politician businessman who sees this. And he says, no, you know, America is unique. America is unique because it has a middle class, because it supports its own manufacturing and industrial base, because it creates things. And you know, the thing about Donald Trump, and you see this if you read what Chairman Xi in China or Vladimir Putin says about Donald Trump's center of gravity. This is what the Chinese say about him. Donald Trump's center of gravity is that he is anti-communist and that he is a true production capitalist, not a financial capitalist who makes money for moving money or investing, but a production capitalist because he makes money by building things. And so the American public intuitively recognized his willingness to say things that were unsayable under the politically correct rules that had been established. And he was speaking to them, you know, who had watched as their factory jobs went away, as their towns were hollowed out, And, you know, Donald Trump didn't win the presidency, and he certainly didn't win states like Michigan and Pennsylvania because he was, you know, the most conservative. He won because he spoke to those Rust Belt people who had seen their, you know, their towns hollowed out.
Right.
As companies all, you know, fled to China and the endless labor supply there.
Well, yeah, I think that then candidate Trump tapped into that deep vein of concern among the citizens that America was at risk and basically slipping away. And then you had the globalists and the Islamists that recognized for their vision to succeed, America, both as an ideal and a national political identity, had to be destroyed. So then you had the atomization of society, which had to occur. And this is where I think it got nefarious at an individual level. So you had attacks directed at all levels of group and personal identity. Hence the sexism, racism, xenophobia, all the memes that were out there. And as a Judeo-Christian culture, it forced inclusion of postmodern notions of tolerance and that are designed to induce nihilism. And as Americans, it's just not in our DNA to be like that. And I think that's what Trump tapped into.
That's exactly what he tapped into. And I think that, you know, you're articulating it in the way that, you know, I had framed it inside of the original memo that I wrote when I was at the White House. But I think if you, you know, if you simplify it, it really was about turning America into, you know, instead of, you know, from many one, from many, many, right?
Right.
And I think you see some of that strategy playing itself out right now today with, you know, groups like Black Lives Matter and the, you know, the forced inclusion of critical race theory training in our institutions, which, you know, the president is pushing back against.
It's been going on a long time, though. I mean, that didn't just start yesterday.
Correct. We're 30 years into this and 100 years into the Marxist revolution worldwide. And, you know, we largely, I guess, lowered our defenses at the end of the Cold War to particularly the cultural Marxist threat and the Marxist threat. And we now see them making tremendous, you know, tremendous strides inside the system. And I think subconsciously people sensed something was wrong, right?
Right.
And I think they intuitively, I tell this to people all the time, people knew the candidate Trump was right without being able to articulate why he was.
Right.
And I think that it's that candidate Trump and, you know, his position of defending America in America that made him the president. And I think he's done a really good job. I mean, the COVID thing has been weaponized against him so effectively by the left. It's really put him on his heels, but he's even fighting through that now. I mean, it really is just an amazing thing to watch.
It is. And, you know, we talked about this, the COVID thing basically showed us that we not only have a counter state in government, but that we also have a counter state in academic medicine, because you had a lot of people that were either just putting out misinformation or too afraid to say anything for fear they were wrong. And, you know, so basically you had the Marxists that were working together with the media, that were working together with academia. And then you had the globalists or the corporatists, the bankers that were supporting all these guys. And I mean, it was a toxic brew. And then they use COVID, and then they try to use their same tactics of polarizing people and shaming them or just basically cutting off any dissent. And I believe even with all those headwinds, the fact that we went so high in unemployment up into the late 20s, almost 30%, and we're down now to 8, I think is a testament to just the tenaciousness of President Trump.
Yeah, I think, you know, and you see it in the Biden campaign strategy now, right? Which is they know that COVID is their only real play. If we could rewind the clock back to February 5th, his State of the Union speech, you know, he wins hands down, no question about it, right? The economy's just booming along, no new wars. And COVID was an opportunity for them. These opportunistic, semi-tyrannical governors in places like Virginia and New York and Michigan, who, you know, they really just, they don't care about the damage they do to the American middle class because it's a feature, not a bug. They truly do believe in these hard left revolutionary ideas. And, you know, the American middle class has always stood in their way, as has the nationalist has always stood in their way. And they know this. And so you hear, you know, senior officials in the Democrat Party, you know, these aren't fringe elements anymore. I mean, the former Secretary of State, Kerry, calling for revolution. The VP of the United States, who's now their presidential candidate, calling for revolution. Their former candidate for president of the United States, calling for revolution. And we have to take that seriously.
No, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's funny, they're talking about the Marxist state, the counter state, but it seems a lot of those on the left and the Marxists have gotten in bed, although they're being very quiet with the Islamists. And I've heard you articulate this before, and I think it's important that people understand we're up against multiple counter-American ideologies that are coalescing together to bring this president and ultimately the middle class and the American people down.
Yeah, I always say all ideology, insofar as it constrains your ability to reason or think, is profoundly un-American. And the whole idea of, you know, this form of government was, you know, that people could have their own ideas, and then through consensus and debate and, you know, sometimes that debate could be pretty heated, you know, and hostile, but we'd all come to some sort of a, you know, a consensus of the governed that we, you know, we would move in a certain direction. What we've seen over the past 50, 60 years is just an ever-increasing just drift towards the application of just hard power as the means through which they do things. First through the courts, you know, where they're bringing issues forward for public referendums, and then, you know, despite what the public wants, they're using the courts to jam at home. I think that's one of the other things that the president has as his legacy, and this is where Mitch McConnell's been very helpful, is helping you know right the ship of the court system. And then to go back to your first question and elaborate on that a little bit, yeah, the Islamists walked into an America or ground that had already been tilled by the Marxists.
No question. Yeah, no question. As far back as the 80s, really.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can go back to 1962 with Hassan, you know, where they Muslim Brotherhood first set up shop in the United States, and it was 62, 63, I believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they came in and they saw this, you know, quote unquote, decadent left. But what most people don't realize is that Said Qutb, who wrote the book Milestones, which is sort of, you know, the governing doctrine for the Muslim Brotherhood, for Al-Qaeda, for the Islamic State, which is, you know, milestones, the incremental steps by which you bring a society to Islamic rule. That author, Said Qutb, who, by the way, studied in the United States in 1949, 1950 in Colorado, he also wrote a second book. He wrote it actually before Milestones, and the name of that book was Social Justice in Islam. And it is about how the Islamists can work with Marxists in order to bring about the revolution. And, you know, just so many Americans, even within the counterterrorism community, don't know this about their overall strategic approach.
They don't know that the left has a strong chance of reducing Western civilization to its benefit, and then they just get co-opted. You know, the postmodern narrative has critical points, and then the Islamists will just co-opt the whole thing once it's brought to a certain level and at some future, I think.
Right. Well, once they control the narrative, everybody else is reacting to them, right? I mean, this is the danger of the, you know, of the Marxist control over our media institutions in particular. You know, when you go back and you look at the early Marxist doctrine, whether you go back, you talk about Hegel and this their concept of Aufheben der Kultur is what they called it in German, but it's basically negation of culture. Well, doesn't right. that sound familiar, right? Cancel culture. So what they do is they get you to destroy your own culture. And that's what we see rolling itself out day in, day out, where, you know, we boycott the NFL or we boycott the NBA because they're doing stuff that we don't like. And we are slowly whittling away at our own culture. It is really a sick pathology that the Marxist ideology puts forward. And the Islamists are more than happy to help them along.
Bring me back to life.
Feel the sound playing in your head with Z-Bone's Bone Conduction Headphones. Innovative tech and Bluetooth 5.0 connects Z-Bones to your smartphone, tablet, laptop, or desktop computers and TVs. And the open-ear design of Z-Bones allows you to hear clear audio from your device and maintain awareness of the environment around you. Z-Bone's comfortable pads rest in front of your ears. Audio vibrations move through your cheekbones into the inner ear. And Z-Bone's ergonomic design provide long-term wearing comfort for sweat-proof active listening. They won't fall off, and they can't fall out. Whether it's music, podcast, or streaming radio, the result is a unique audio experience with clear sound from your device while still hearing your surroundings. And the built-in mic delivers crystal clear audio for phone calls. Learn more and buy Z-Bones at zbones.io. Zbones.io. Save at checkout with code SCALPEL70. Zbones.io. Quality sound that moves you. The Scalpel continues with Dr. Keith Rose and his guest, Rich Higgins, president and CEO of HTG LLC, a company that develops, tests, and evaluates new combat capabilities for special operations, intelligence, and information warfare, and author of The Memo, 20 Years Inside the Deep State, Fighting for America First.
So you have President Trump right now, who is, I pray, going to be elected for a second term. But what do you see right now as President Trump's administration's strengths? And then I want you to tell me what you see as their weaknesses coming into this election.
Well, I think the president's greatest strengths in terms of his current state of being is that he understands these narrative fights, right? And the president is actually their greatest asset insofar as his it was a convergence of a couple different things. His understanding of economy and his understanding of sort of the financial world, beneficial, certainly. But his understanding of the media and the information world and this, you know, kind of cult celebrity, right, has really made him incredibly effective in terms of his ability to fight back. He's fighting alone. Very few Republicans have actually come alongside him and fought this fight. I mean, for example, we see the Republicans out there condemning these Q followers, and I'm not a Q person, but out there the Republicans can muster a vote and condemn the Q followers, but we have yet to see a resolution condemning Antifa. Really remarkable, right?
Right. They seem like they're just they're licking their fingers and seeing which way the wind blows. And if the president gets going good, some of them will jump over, but they always have a foot on both sides.
Yeah, they're happy to let him fight the fights, right? And they stand behind him, right? They're not very good wingmen.
No.
And I think in terms of the weakness, I think there's one area that I think the president has had his issues, and that is this personnel, right? And he's fixing it, and he has been fixing it for the past 6 months. He's got his new guy running the presidential personnel office, John McEntee, who's fantastic, complete MAGA guy, bringing in MAGA guys. But, you know, he's undoing, you know, several years worth of damage that had been done by the establishment, both with Obama holdovers and some of these never Trumpers that had slipped through the cracks and into the administration.
Now, and how do you think going in to this election, when it happens, and say President Trump wins in a landslide, what do you see? Because you, when we first met, you know, we were in a pretty secure area, and you and I had a frank discussion. And I got to say, everything you told me that would happen has happened. I mean, you called it straight down the line. So where do you see happening when President Trump is reelected? And what would you recommend for just everyday citizens? What should they do? How should they respond? Because you and I both spent a lot of time in a lot of areas around the world working on information warfare, covert action. We saw this coming together. I think there's a few of us that saw this coming and said, you know what, we've got to stand, even when people were calling us crazy. What would you tell people right now that they're going to need to do? I like I've said, you know, these, I love these MAGA parades where people are getting out, because nothing causes more, you know, disassociation in an insurgency, you know, where people look at it and go, I may be not in the right place, when they see these massive outpouring of support for President Trump, because we're not going to get it in the media. They're getting 24/7 barrage of, you know, Orange Man bad, when our president has had accomplishments that no other president almost since Reagan has even come close to.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't like making bold predictions. What I do want people, though, to understand is that what I see emerging as a pattern is the pattern that has been used by the United States with some of our allies in the past to particularly target countries in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, which is known as the color revolution. Now, there are some folks out there talking about this, Darren Beatty and some others who've been pushing it on Twitter. You may be familiar with it, but there are really four things that I think you need to know about a color revolution. We'll just go through them real quick. Number one is the role of the actors in the color revolution is to change your perception of events, right? You meaning the listening audience on this podcast. And the way they're going to do that is they're going to really take on four different, I'll call them four different perceptive windows that they want to control. So, you know, they want you to doubt yourself. And the way they're going to do that is they're going to use the media and the social media, obviously. So if Trump wins handily and the Democrats decide they want to count votes forever, or they're not going to send their electors, or, you know, whatever,
a lot of soft power, right? Like actors, sports figures, things like that.
The Dems will use crisis engineering to generate a controversy around the election, the legitimacy of the election, the virtuosity of the election, etc. Then they will use social media and media personalities and capabilities in order to shape our perception of events, maybe even to limit our communications. They will then have institutions. For example, the head of the FBI coming out and saying that X country hacked the election. Or you will have international forums, the United Nations, for example, or NATO coming out and criticizing that, you know, there was an issue with this election. And then what I'm worried about more than anything else is then you will not, you know, you may see, we saw it in Egypt in particular during their color revolution, the integration of mass street violence, you know, where the left, who is allegedly upset with this, you know, illegitimate election, adopts mass street violence.
Like a Tahrir Square.
Right, it's rear square type of thing. So I think we need to be mindful of these events operating in sync, not as individual happenstance. And it's vital that people become familiar with these tactics so that, you know, when you see them being deployed, you're able to maintain your sense of self and perception.
Yeah, situational awareness in the information realm is important. I played that video from Event 201 where the PR specialist said that they were going to have to get, so people would get the quote correct information. They would have to turn social media into more of a broadcasting platform. And I think we're starting to see that right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's vital.
And they're trying to limit us. So what advice would you give right now? And the reason I'm asking the advice you give to the president's team, as far as, and I know you, the personnel changes have been really good and important, but where would they have to look in the future? Where are they? What are the top three issues that they're going to have to address in his next term?
Well, I think the number one issue they're going to have to address is the current state of the economy, right? I mean, we have to deal with the post-COVID hangover, right? The second thing I think we're going to have to deal with is the entire Southeast Asia national security portfolio. We're going to have to adopt something that's more reality-based in terms of the regional interests and how those regional interests actually juxtapose against our interests. This isn't to say that that China gets a pass, but I think what we want to look at is, okay, we don't want a war with China. China certainly doesn't want a war with us. There are certain pressure points in that region that we need to pay attention to. And then the last thing, and I think this is probably the hardest of the three, is we need to look at what we do about this domestic Marxist issue. And how do we go about getting these ideologies, and particularly the Marxist ideology, out of our schools, out of our institutions, beginning to recognize that the culture war is, and in and of itself, is a national security issue.
and it has to be addressed in some form or fashion.
You know, I've even heard it stated that by a mutual friend of ours, they should move the Secretary of Education to the Secretary of Defense and make this a national security issue.
Yeah, and it goes beyond even education now. I mean, it's so deep inside of the culture. I mean, it's in our music.
All this critical race theory, yeah.
Oh, just in general, the Marxist training. I mean, I have a daughter who is a teenager, and, you know, she has a teacher in high school. This guy is a hardcore Marxist with refused fascism posters on the wall in her classroom. And I mean, it's completely out of control. It needs to be brought under control somehow. And I do chalk it up as one of the top three national security issues facing the country. It may even be number one.
I think most internally, and my concern, and I'd like your thoughts on this, is where we have fallen as an intelligence community. Because I don't believe right now that for the money spent, we're actually getting the best bang for our buck as far as in the world.
Well, I mean, that would require 5 phone calls and 10 interviews, right?
Right. No, that's something we talk about a lot.
Right. But I mean, look, the politically correct culture and the institutional kind of bureaucratic cultures, they exist to inhibit the mission function, right? I mean, that's what they do. It's just the nature of the beast. I think the PC culture, particularly the leftist PC culture that has infected all of our institutions, has been extreme. You know, where the cases are severe in many of our institutions. I mean, the IC and the intel community in particular, I think their case is it's lethal. You know, they're dysfunctional because of how politically correct they have become. Where, you know, the thing about intelligence, it's kind of, you know, since you're a doctor, we'll use a doctor analogy. You know, if you're a doctor and you go in and you do heart surgery and you put the patient's heart in upside down and backwards and the patient dies, you're accountable for that, right? What we've seen in the intelligence community is they don't even know what a heart looks like. They open up the heart to do heart surgery. You know, they don't put the heart back in and the patient dies and they get a bigger budget.
Right. And they say that it was the patient's fault for having the heart in that position.
Right. And so there's a huge shift in accountability and deliver, you know, the deliverables of the intelligence community that has to happen. I got to be honest with you. I blame the institutions of the intelligence community less than I blame the Senate for their lack of oversight.
It goes back to our founders talking about virtue and such. And the intelligence communities have grown so big. You know, my old boss and I spent a lot of time talking about this. It's like a big self-licking ice cream cone. And there's no mission to be achieved. The only level of success is how you move from within the organization instead of accomplishing what you have outside the organization. And I think one of the reasons they went out after General Flynn is I think he probably threatened their budgets. He probably threatened, he saw inside, and I was privileged enough to work with General Flynn, and you know, I think that's one of the reasons he was targeted.
I think that's definitely one of the reasons he was targeted. I don't think it's the only reason. I think that the real target of all of it was President Trump. And I think that they knew with General Flynn, that General Flynn had enough enemies in the intelligence community and you know, just across the government because he had been so disruptive, that they might be able to get away with things by going after him that they wouldn't have been able to get away with if they went after somebody else that was part of the new administration. And, you know, when you see what they did.
And he had incurred the ire of President Obama, too.
Well, right. And so all of Obama's deputies and sycophants who still populated many of these institutions, I think of, you know, for example, Sally Yates and others, they were willing to take a little bit more risk because there was certainly with McCabe, there was a personal animus there that you know, drove them to do things that where they went after General Flynn that they may not have been willing to do with others. And I think, you know, the thing about General Flynn is, you know, for people I've had the pleasure of working with him, he is a completely mission focused, soldier first type of general. And he's rare for that.
Yeah, no, I worked with him, and I can tell you, after my first boss, he was the best second boss you could have, you know, as far as he totally was. What was the problem? How are you going to fix it? And that's what President Trump does, too. President Trump comes from the real world where you don't get paid to be there. You get paid to solve problems. And in government, you get it seems like you get paid or you get your growth in government when you create a problem that can't be solved so that you need more money to solve the unsolvable problem. And for folks like General Flynn, President Trump, they're not wired like that. And how do we get back to getting those guys like yourself and like others I know back into the circle and start fixing these problems?
Hey, we're you know, I think, you know, doing things like this podcast and, you know, writing, I just myself penned a new book, and I'll plug it while we're here on the air.
Please do.
The book is called The Memo, after the famous or infamous National Security Council memo. But the subtitle on it is 20 years inside the deep state fighting for America first. And, you know, I wrote the book because I think people needed to understand the worldview and the frame that I had as I was observing these events early in the Trump administration. You know, I had been in the government for, you know, a couple of decades. I had seen the tools that, you know, we saw being deployed against the president of the United States.
It was a little bizarre.
Yeah, these were the same tools we'd use against Saddam Hussein.
Exactly. Or we're using it in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places. Yeah,
exactly. And so the book is about sort of my own awakening and my own sort of red pill experience as to, you know, why do we keep trying to do the right thing? You know, why do we keep trying to do the mission? And these forces from, you know, my perception at the time was these forces from on high were opposed to that. And so the book is it's a coming of age story inside the deep state. And then, you know, a recognition that, you know, to be America first was to be an insurgent inside your own government institutions. And, you know, another part of the story is to let the public know that there are a lot of patriots stuck in these institutions that want to do the right thing, you know, but they're, you know, instead of focusing on the mission, they're being hauled off to, you know, the next critical race theory class or whatever other nonsense they're shoving at them this week. And the institutions themselves, maybe not all of them, you know, wink, wink, FBI, but Roger. The other institutions themselves are worth saving. The FBI may be too foregone right now, and the same, but we'll see.
Same for the CIA, I'm afraid. There's something else that's going to have to come out of that or fixed.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, in World War II, I mean, the public hears that and they say, yeah, okay, you know, let's move some institutions around. Right? I mean, in World War II, they created 132 new organizations to fight World War II, 132 of them. And they got rid of old ones and, you know, removed generals. And
they fired generals. I was going to say, you know, if you didn't do the job, you were removed. And it didn't matter how old you were. It mattered what you got done.
Right. And I think that we need to return to the American culture of self-reliance, accountability, right? Command.
Competition.
Competition in a healthy sense, right? I mean,
right.
there's a lot of thing about, when I think about America, I think the last great vestige of America today is the homeschooling movement. And, you know, when I think about America, I think, you know, husband and wife, maybe a couple kids in tow, getting in a covered wagon and heading to Oklahoma, right? From one of the port cities in the East. And they didn't have any. They were just going to eke out a living on their own, but they were going to be self-reliant. And I'm hoping that we can return to that culture.
And I think people will. Now, if folks want to get your book, where do they go to purchase your book?
Yeah, it's available on Barnes & Noble and on Amazon. It's like it's $20. There's going to be an audio book coming out in a couple weeks. I've just started doing these podcasts, I'm targeting it to the MAGA people, right? So you're probably not going to see me doing many interviews or book hits on mainstream media. This is a book that was written by MAGA for MAGA.
Well, you're going to be on Charlie's podcast, Charlie Kirk's podcast tomorrow, correct?
I'm told I'm going to be. My publicist will give me the details.
I will tell you, I'm going to call Charlie when we hang up, and I'm going to say that this is important, and I know he will. Charlie is... you know, a huge, like myself, a huge supporter of the president. And an amazing patriot. And it's guys like Charlie and his buddy, his producer Andrew, that are younger, that gives guys like you and I, who are not old, but we're not as young yet. We've been around a little while fighting it out, have a few scars to show for it. These guys are out there in the trenches, and I think they're the future of MAGA. Not the future of the Republicans, but the future of people that truly want to get back to constitutional values and make this country great again. Well, man, I can't thank you enough for taking time. I know you're super busy and you have a new baby, so you probably don't get a lot of sleep as well as all the work you're doing.
I get a lot more sleep now than I did when I was in the military. So I'm good.
Yeah, that's what I say. I get more food and I get more sleep, and I don't wake up to loud noises as much. So, well, listen, brother, I appreciate it, and God bless. And I do believe that God has his hand on this president, and that's the only thing that really makes sense to me. So know that we're praying for you out there, brother. Everyone go out and get this book. I can't even begin to tell you how much you'll learn. Barnes & Noble, look it up online, go to Amazon, and get in touch and have a conversation with someone else. And most importantly, everybody out there, let's keep freedom rolling.
Head high, protest line, freedom scribbled on your sign. Headline, New York Times, standing on the edge of a revolution. Hey, hey, just obey, your secret's safe with the NSA. And God we trust, or the CIA, standing on the edge of a revolution.
The Scalpel with Dr. Keith Rose. The Scalpel is proudly sponsored by Z-Bones Bone Conducting Headphones. Learn more at zbones.io. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to The Scalpel wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at The Scalpel Podcast, on Twitter at The Scalpel Edge, email kfr@scalpeledge.com, or the website scalpeledge.com.